The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Welcome to Feedback Friday. I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with Feedback Friday producer, a guy whose new leather bracelets look like he's, 9 months away from starting a yoga cult in Tulum, Gabriel Mizrahi.
Nine? Yeah, more like six tops. Have you seen these things?
Yeah, wearing like four bracelets. I thought you would have learned something from the Sarah and Nippy cult interview, but I guess not.
Look, it's not a cult if you're the one starting it, okay?
It's going to be a no for me, dog.
On the Jordan Harbinger Show, we decode the stories, secrets, and skills of the world's most fascinating people and turn their wisdom into practical advice that you can use to impact your own life and those around you. We want to help you see the matrix when it comes to how these amazing people think and behave. And our mission is to help you become a better informed, more critical thinker so you can get a much deeper understanding of how the world works and make sense of what's really happening, even inside your own mind, unless you're Gabe with his bracelets is just not sinking in for this guy. If you're new to the show, on Fridays, we give advice to you. Was that a gift from your sister? I feel bad if it was a gift from your mom or something.
It was a Christmas gift. One of my really good friends gave this to me, and she listens to the show, so I just want you to know.
Okay,
really
great.
Hurt her feelings, yeah.
Sorry. Anyway. I'm just digging a hole. If you're new to the show, on Fridays, we give advice to you and answer listener questions. The rest of the week, we have long-form interviews, conversations with a variety of amazing folks, from spies to CEOs, athletes to authors, thinkers to performers. This week, we had Apollo Ono, my new homeboy, Apollo Ono, on being an Olympian, mindset, motivation, routines, competition, even purpose and depression. Really good conversation with multi-gold medal winning Apollo Ono. And Rami Romani on ancient Egypt, pyramids, tombs, and a narrow escape from a revolution. Just killing it this week, if I do say so myself. So make sure you've had a look and a listen to everything that we created for you here this week. Now, before we dive in, Gabe, I just remembered something funny from like 2006.
Great, tell me.
Back then, I lived in Hell's Kitchen, which I think they call it Clinton Hill now or something like that, but it's Hell's Kitchen. I lived in Hell's Kitchen with two lesbians for a while. And the way I found a place on Craigslist, and I didn't know what arrow bed was, and I didn't know what railroad apartment room was. I didn't know any of these terms that they use for New York.
Wait, what is arrow bed?
It's an air mattress.
Oh, but arrow bed?
They've called it an arrow bed.
Oh, A-E-R-O.
Yes, a arrow bed.
Got it. Okay. Like you thought it was going to be a proper room and it was just an air mattress?
Yeah, and not only was it an air mattress, it was in the hallway between their bedroom and the kitchen, which was also in, like there was a, it was one of those apartments that used to be someone's house who was wealthy and now is like 12 apartments. Mm-hmm. So they had a tiny bathroom, a hallway, up a giant staircase, and then their bedroom. And another guy then also moved in and slept on this couch that was basically just in storage in the hallway because it was too small for anything else. And this guy was really tall. So what they did was they said, don't sleep on the couch. It's too uncomfortable. He had to sleep on the floor. There was no room for me to also sleep on the floor or the couch. So they let me sleep in their bedroom on the floor. And so—
Wait.
Yeah.
Hold on. You moved into your roommate's bedroom?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. How old are you at the time?
I'm probably like 26. So you're just a little bit too old to do this kind of thing, but also too poor.
Yeah, right on the line. Okay.
Yeah. Too poor to have
Understood.
Any other options.
Yeah.
Because I was like an intern at the law firm at the time. I was getting paid, but it was like, I just didn't know how to find a place in New York.
Got
I don't want
it.
To pay a broker, blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
So, amazing. So I'm sleeping in the room and they're like, hey, at night we watch TV. Do you mind? I'm like, of course not. So they're watching The L Word, which is this show about lesbians that had there was no show about gay people on TV, right
at all. That was the first big one.
Yeah. Yep,
totally.
And so I am watching this with two lesbians who live in New York, and I just had this amazing front row seat to something I would never have experienced anywhere else, probably in the whole world. And one of them looked like Demi Moore, and we would walk to the subway in the morning because I would be going downtown. She would be going to like Queens or whatever for a job. And everybody who saw her would be like, oh, it's G.I. Jane. Hey, or people would go, I'm a huge fan. You're so amazing. She really was a dead ringer for Demi Moore. And she also had that short hair and everything. And it was really funny because it really felt like walking with an A-list celebrity. People would stare, honk, run up to us. It was quite funny. But I also used to hear all of their intimate bedroom conversations, which was also quite educational. So they'd, of course, have these very normal couple conversations. But one of them was so similar to me in thinking that it was like she was reading my mind. You know when you hear somebody argue and you're like, where's my opinion on this matter, even if
yes,
you don't know
totally,
them?
Yeah.
So yeah. I would listen to them whisper arguing and like they think I can't hear them or something, even though I'm literally right next to them on the floor, like a foot away. And like if she rolled over to the edge of the bed and drooled, it would land on me. That's how close I was mm-hmm. to these people.
That's too close is what that is. Yeah.
The one was just reading my mind in terms of what they would say in their arguments and conversations. And they were both working at these nonprofits. We were just from different planets, right?
Wait, but that is amazing, though. Like, yeah. You're sitting there 3.5 feet away from them while they're like, well, I didn't really appreciate the way you talked to me in the kitchen.
Yeah, oh, 100%. Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, well, what I would say is that, well, I don't think you put the top back in the top. Like, that's what I'm picturing.
It really was like that. And it's like, who cares if the cap's off the toothpaste? It doesn't dry out. It's not a liquid. It kind of is, but it's not really. Yeah, you know? And I'm thinking, yeah, I mean, who cares? But also the other person.
It's so toothpaste. Can we go on soon?
It was just so interesting. And of course, I'm like, not during these conversations, but during the day or whatever, when I see them, I'm like, okay, I have a question. Da, da, da. Or they'd be like, you can't, not to be all up in your business, but you're going out, right? You shouldn't, don't wear that lanyard name tag thing. And I'm like, well, what do I do with it? I'm going to and from work. They're like, you got to put it in your pocket. Don't wear a suit. It's so, it's cliche. Everybody sees through that. You're trying to date women, right? Straight women, this is not going to work for you. So it's funny because I had like coaching them as well. And we'd be in the bathroom. I'm brushing my teeth right next to them and stuff. I mean, we were really, it was like I was this weird third wheel that didn't quite have all the benefits of a relationship.
I feel like I've seen this sitcom before.
Right, yeah.
But I can't put my finger on it. It's great. Like single straight guy with two lesbian women
it's
in New York
definitely,
City. Solid pitch.
Yeah, it's definitely like Will and Grace, only I'm Grace and also less, maybe a little bit less right. something than Deborah Messing was. Anyway, the point of the story is if you can immerse yourself in a different culture by traveling abroad, amazing. But we see letters where people are like, yeah, it looks really fun. I can never do this. I don't have enough money. I work two jobs that I'm not going to go live in Spain. You know, I rented that place off Craigslist and most of us aren't going to do something like that either. But I just recommend here in 2023, get into something, a new hobby, a new situation, a new town, a new friend group, whatever it is, dip a toe in those waters and see what's what. Because you're going to learn a ton about that world and the people in it, both of which are really important. And I feel like experiences like this really opened me up. Living abroad, yes, but also doing something crazy like that, even for a couple months, it keeps your brain nice and elastic, but it also just really opens you up to the world and the people in it. Because I think a lot of the political division we're seeing right now is because people go, well, if you don't think like me, it's because there's something wrong with you. And you don't really appreciate that different people have crazy different lifestyles and experiences.
Mm-hmm.
A truck driver who's living paycheck to paycheck and living in middle America, of course they think differently than some tech guy in Menlo Park, obviously.
Right.
But both of these people tend to think the other person's some kind of uneducated or ignorant jackass because they don't understand how the other type lives. For example, here in 2023, Jaden got 4 radio control cars for Christmas. Every single one of them broke within like 24 to 48 hours. Most of it was not our fault. One of them was. I ran it into something and the wheel fell off. So I go to the hobby shop. I buy a car for him. He's flipping loving it. And I go, this is fun. I play with it while he's gone. I go back to the hobby shop the next day and I buy myself a car because I'm like, this is kick ass. Then I'm watching YouTube going down these rabbit holes. I go back to the hobby shop like a week later, not even, and I buy the biggest one that they have. Mm-hmm. Huge. Weighs like 30 pounds. You know, takes these batteries that can explode if you don't charge them properly. I mean, just awesome. I'm like super into it. And there's this huge hobby scene. Jaden and I are outside every day at the park doing jumps and running these things through the mud. It's just really, really fun. So I recommend to, because people will go, what kind of hobby should I pick? I don't understand. Find something you loved as a kid that maybe you couldn't afford, and now maybe you can. You know, if you like Legos, but you couldn't get the pirate ship, go to the Lego store, grab something. Think of it like a puzzle. You don't have to have kids to enjoy this stuff. I really do think that there's some benefit to picking up something small, some small hobby that you really get into. or even just medium get into, because it'll open your mind up about the world. It'll open your mind up about not thinking about work all the time. There's really just huge benefits to this. And I think a lot of us have ditched our hobbies in favor of workaholism. I know I sure have. And I highly recommend people just stop doing that to themselves here this year, especially because we might be heading into a recession. It's real easy to just worry all the time. Last bit of housekeeping here. We have a new ads platform, and it appears to be inserting some ads that I have not approved. Someone said they heard a gambling ad on the show, so if you hear something like this, please let me know. Unfortunately, these ads are inserted via computer server. I can't go and listen to it on my own. It'll insert a different ad depending on where you live and all that stuff. I have to take your word for it. But if you know where the company is or what the company name is, I can block them. Same thing for any ad on the show. If you hear something sketchy, you hear something weird that's not in my voice. If it's in my voice, I know about it. If it's not in my voice, I don't know about it. And I want you to report those to me if they're really gross advertisers. This happens both inside and outside of the United States. In fact, the initial complaint came from a listener in Australia. And by the way, I love that y'all are so protective of the show. It's really helpful. I really appreciate you guys for it. All right, long ass intro. Hopefully there was some value in there. Gabe, what's the first thing out of the mailbag?
Hi, Jordan and Gabe. I'm an adopted middle child and was treated as such by both my adopted mother and her family. She would tell me that if it weren't for her, I would be dead. She also put me in headlocks when I was a kid and held knives to my throat.
What?
Saying she would kill me.
Jesus.
As time went on, her narcissistic attitude made me completely mute and afraid of her, and I would only speak in a quiet tone and only when asked. She was also very homophobic, even though her gay friends would babysit us every so often. She even pulled me out of my year 6 concert because she said the song was for, quote-unquote, faggots and poofters.
Oof.
That's a word you don't hear very often.
No.
The F word you still hear, but poofter is such an old-timey...
What, that sounds like some sort of 70s thing.
I feel like it's like a 70s or 80s slur for gay people. It's so weird to hear that.
Oof. Yeah. But also, this person is nuts. Wow.
Yeah, she's a piece of work. Okay. I used to go to school every day and hang off the balcony and tell myself not to let go, even though the kids at the bottom watching me would tell me to let go.
Ugh, this is so heartbreaking and so cruel. Jeez.
I know. So sad. Okay, it continues. Eventually, I told my family that I was sexually abused as a child by two different people in the family. Not my adopted mother's gay friends, by the way, but two other people who have wives and kids. When I told her, she said, "If you tell people, what will they think of me?" It was at that point that I lost all sympathy for her. But years later, I felt like I couldn't get rid of her. She would pull me back in, telling people to tell me to speak to her because she twisted the facts to make me seem like the bad guy. So I wrote an article about everything I had been through and pointed out her homophobia and my mental health. I now know she wants nothing to do with me, and that's fine. I've gone to meet the royal family, I've been published in the New York Times, I've published books, I've even completed my degree at the best university in the country. But I keep it all on the down low because I feel embarrassed to share the good news with my family after writing that article. I didn't say anything about her trying to kill me or the sexual assault, but the whole family hate me for pointing it out, and now everyone knows about the two men. Although no one really makes a fuss about them, they only make a fuss about me. Is it normal for families to exclude someone for pointing out these things? Signed, a middle child, a little exiled.
Oh, man. This is quite a story. Quite a family to be brought into. I'm almost at a loss for words here, Gabe. It's just hard for me to imagine a mother this cruel. This woman is almost cartoonishly evil.
It's also hard to wrap your head around the idea that somebody would want to adopt a child and then turn around and treat them this way.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Adoption is such an amazing thing to do, right? But then you abuse your adopted child and ignore them when they tell you that something awful happened to them and use them to prop yourself up, which, yeah, okay, sounds like pretty textbook narcissism on top of some really other awful stuff. I don't know. It's just, It's interesting that such a cruel person could do something as noble as adopt a child, but obviously bad people can do seemingly good things. In this case, I think do supposedly good things for their own creepy frickin' purposes. Mm-hmm. Who knows what's really going on with this woman? She sounds like a very sad, complicated case.
Also, putting aside the objectively horrific stuff she did, she sounds very confused. I mean, a homophobe with gay friends who lets them babysit her kids? Like, what?
Yeah, the woman, she's mental. Clearly incapable of any kind of integrity or self-reflection. It's pretty wild. And I am so sorry that you've been through all this. It's not easy to grow up with an abusive, mentally ill parent like this, obviously. And then to be bullied at school and sexually abused by two different people and to not be cared for by the one person who should actually be caring for you and to have her actually shut you down because talking about it makes her look bad. I mean, this is just really traumatizing stuff. And my heart goes out to you, man. It really does. And yet, Gabe, look at how much this guy has managed to accomplish in his life. It's pretty impressive.
I was about to say, it is extraordinary. This dude is writing for one of the biggest newspapers in the world. He's publishing books. He's having tea sandwiches with Prince Charles. Mm-hmm. This is a very impressive guy.
Yeah, I'm actually blown away that somebody who was ground down and tormented as a kid has gone on to have such an illustrious career and a strong voice too, at least literarily, right?
Sure.
This childhood clearly did a number on him, but he's still participating in the world, chasing after big goals. He just must have a ton of grit and courage. And I want to appreciate that because I think that speaks to this guy's remarkable personality and resilience.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Although what I find so heartbreaking is that that same impressive guy can still feel so powerless when it comes to his mother. Like he said, he felt he couldn't get rid of her. I think that speaks to how profound the relationship with a mother is, even if it's a terrible mother.
Yeah, but also how effective narcissists really are at keeping people in their orbit, mother or no.
Right, yeah. He can kick it with the queen, but he can't tell his crazy, self-obsessed mom to F off.
Exactly. Still some kind of connective tissue between him and his mom, mm-hmm. and that's just making it hard for him to fully separate. Which, look, all parents, even healthy ones, we carry them inside of us, right? We're always connected to them, but with a malignant, manipulative, narcissistic parent like this, that connective tissue is usually a lot stronger and it's trickier to untangle because it's actually, instead of being this healthy bird's nest for you to take off into life, it's more like a restraint.
Yeah. So what is that connective tissue, do you think? Is it guilt?
I'm sure that's a big one. It could also be a sense of loyalty towards this woman, despite everything that she's done. It could be some residual love, as strange as that sounds. I mean, she did adopt him. He did grow up with her. People love horrible mm-hmm. people all the time. It's a tale as old as time. Mm-hmm. It could also be fear. You know, he's an adult, but there might be a part of him that's still terrified of this woman. She freaking held a knife to his throat. She threatened to kill him when he was a kid. So,
right, at a vulnerable age.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
That also makes me wonder if maybe there's an unconscious wish on some level to keep the door open with her. Because if he does, maybe things could go differently next time.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like he can rewrite the script somehow.
I might be assuming a few things, but he could be reenacting the trauma of their relationship. Because reenacting it for many victims, that can be a way to cope with it and to sort of master it. Like if I go back into the lion's den and I talk to mom again, maybe this time I can beat her at this game, or I can re-experience the wound, but I can experience it in a different way.
Right, right. Or I can just go through it and survive, and that'll make me feel like I'm more in control.
Yes, yes. Very common.
Fascinating. I could see that. So look, you're asking this question. Is it normal for families to exclude somebody for pointing out the terrible things that they did? And I imagine the answer is sadly yes. It probably happens a lot. It's not normal in the sense that it's okay or healthy, but yeah, I have to imagine it happens pretty frequently because many families can't or don't want to acknowledge that something awful has happened. And that is heartbreaking. But I know that's not your real question here, man. The real question is, what do I do about this mom? And my blunt advice, if I may be so bold, is first of all, I think you need to take some real space from this family for a while. Definitely your mom, maybe also these extended family members, whoever's doing this to you. Even if these folks aren't actively hurting you, they're very much missing the point, and they're reinforcing the pain that your mother continues to create for you. And it just sounds to me like you need to pull back. You need to work through this childhood of yours. I hope you're in therapy, obviously, but if you're not, I would get there immediately, and I would start talking about all of this. Top of the agenda here is mom, of course, as it is in every therapy session ever, probably. But mom, what she did to you, how that's showing up in your life now, how she keeps roping you in, how you feel about her these days, how to manage that relationship. But there's also so much around that relationship, the sexual abuse, mm-hmm. the bullying, that middle child feeling you mentioned, which you don't need me to tell you, these are profound wounds. I would love for you to have the support to work through them. And yeah, it'll be pretty hard sometimes, but I'm sure it'll bring a lot of catharsis and clarity to this question about how to relate to your mother. But listen, man, I just got to say this out loud. This woman is a monster. We know this, right? She's deeply troubled. She abused you. She neglected you. She diminished you. She dominated you. She controlled you. She's still controlling you. She is not well. And I know how painful it is to tell your own parent, even a horrible friggin' parent, hey, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you for a while. It's up there with the hardest conversations in life. But honestly, after what she put you through, I do not feel that you owe this woman very much, if anything.
Certainly not a relationship at your own expense.
Definitely not. So taking this space for yourself, I think that might also be a huge relief. It'll give you the mental and emotional space to sort through all of this. And it'll give you the perspective and the peace you need to find out what life is like, yeah, when she's not trying to get her claws into you again. And I'm not saying you have to never talk to her again. That's for you to decide. And that all depends on how she responds. But while you sort through all this, and as long as her presence in your life creates more pain, I do think that would be helpful. And the huge silver lining here is that you have a ton of inner resources to work with. You're resilient as hell. You're insightful. You're sensitive. You're ambitious. You know you deserve better. And those qualities will be huge assets as you work through this. This woman doesn't deserve a son like you. I'm sorry if that sounds a little cheesy. I really mean that. She just doesn't. We're sending you a big hug, man. We're wishing you all the best. It sounds like you've got a great life, but you do need to sort this out or it's always going to nag at you. Well, you know who won't drive you to write an op-ed about all the terrible life-altering things they've done? The amazing sponsors who support this show. We'll be right back. This episode is sponsored in part by Airbnb. You know, Jen and I love trotting around the globe. You gotta trot, you can't gallop or anything. And Airbnbs have become our go-to for a cozy stay wherever we land. So when we finally decided to put down roots and build our own place, we thought, why not sprinkle a bit of that Airbnb magic into our home? We went all out, designed it with a spare bedroom that comes with its own exterior door. This way, our guests can come and go as they please, making check-ins and check-outs a breeze. We've been lucky enough to host folks come into town to visit family and friends. Inspired by our travels, we wanted to make their stay extra special. So we began adding little personal touches here and there, snacks, bottled water, a brochure with our local recommendations that we made, even some cool samples from our show sponsors. It's all about making our guests feel welcomed and cherished. And really, when you think about it, why let your home just sit there gathering dust when it could be your ticket to more incredible adventures? Turning it into an Airbnb not only brings in a little extra cash, but it's also a fantastic way to share a piece of your world with others. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Thank you for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers keeps the lights on around here. All the deals, all the discount codes are all searchable in one place, jordanharbinger.com/deals. You can also search for sponsors using the search box on the website as well, so please consider supporting those who support the show. Now, back to Feedback Friday. All right, what's next?
Hey, Jordan and Gabe. I'm currently in a doctoral physical therapy program after working as a physical therapy assistant for the last 10 years. I've been doing as much training in the physical therapy field that I could afford for the last decade to differentiate myself, over 295 hours of continuing education. This week, one of the faculty members informed me that I'm not well-liked among my classmates. She told me that they view me as an arrogant know-it-all who tries to one-up people. I actually think that's a fair assessment. I'll admit that I've been a bit of a braggart, but I didn't realize my behavior was so toxic. I have a thirst for knowledge. I want to better myself. And I find myself bored with the entry-level information we're going over, so I answer questions so we can just get done with the material and move on. I've begun apologizing to some of my classmates, but there are 96 students in my class, so I can't exactly go around like Billy Madison apologizing to everybody I've wronged, especially when I didn't realize I was that offensive. Also, I'm 37, and most of the students in the class are 24 or 25, so finding common ground is difficult. My concern now is that I'll become so unpopular that the university will ask me to withdraw for failure to mesh with the other students. At this point, I'd prefer to just stop participating and blend into the scenery until I disappear from people's memory. Can the university legally ask me to unenroll if I'm not a good fit? How can I turn this around and just finish the program so I can get on with my life? Signed, a physical therapist, putting his reputation back in alignment.
Ooh, interesting situation. You know, getting a piece of feedback like this, especially when it's about your personality, how you come across to other people, it's really difficult. It can shake you up. It can make you kind of paranoid. I get why this note has been a little hard to integrate. I've definitely have faced similar situations in the past as well. But also, to be fair to you, you're a decade plus older than your peers in this program. You've put in a ton of work. You're much further along than most of them. And I imagine that can be kind of frustrating sometimes. You're bored a little bit. You're eager to learn. You want to move quickly. I can understand that. But in the process of doing that, you've rubbed people the wrong way. So this professor of yours actually did you a huge favor. Mm-hmm. She helped you see yourself in a way that'll shape the rest of your career, probably even your life, which I think is pretty amazing. So just to get your biggest fear out of the way here, no, I seriously doubt the university is going to ask you to leave because of this. You can't get kicked out of a program for being an arrogant know-it-all or even a complete a-hole most of the time. If you could, like half of all law students wouldn't make it 2 weeks before getting the boot. So I really wouldn't stay up at night worrying about that. And I say law students because I went to law school. Everybody who's been in any college program or grad program is like, definitely can't kick out the a-holes. And they're thinking of 20 people in their class of 100 that are just complete knucklehead a-holes. So I just really wouldn't lose any sleep over this. If you are losing sleep over this, crack open your university's code of ethics. Read up on what kinds of stuff gets you kicked out. It's going to be stuff like cheating on an exam, being abusive, stealing, stuff like that. Not raising your hand a lot and maybe being a little bit of a smartass in group work assignments, okay? But the fact that you're so worried that it might happen, it's interesting. I think that speaks to how jarring this feedback was and ultimately how true it was, maybe.
Yeah, but also how scary it is to feel like you're on the outs, right? That hooks into a very primal fear, the fear of being like shunned by the tribe, right? It's kind of our worst nightmare.
Yeah, it's what all humans fear on some level. And it can really send you into a panic, even if the fear is unfounded. So here's my advice. Yes, apologize to your peers if appropriate, especially if you did anything in particular to these individuals. A good apology really does go a long way. We actually talked about what makes an apology a good apology on a past Feedback Friday. You might want to give that a listen. That was episode 738, and we will link to that in the show notes. And also, at some point, we'll have an AI bot, a chat bot, that you can ask questions like, how do I give a good apology? And it'll return results from the show. It may be up already by the time you listen to this. It's we've been days away from launch for a few weeks now. The chatbot will be on the website. You'll be able to see it right at the top nav or something like that when we get it. It'll probably be at jordanharbinger.com/AI, TBD on all that. But even more important than apologizing is changing, behaving differently, treating people better, approaching your program and your peers in a new way. If you stop raising your hand so often, if you let your peers catch up to where you are, if you don't try to flex on everyone all the time, people will notice that. And they'll realize that you've learned something and that you're willing to grow, and they'll appreciate that. And they'll probably start responding to you in a very different way. In my experience, that is much more impactful than going around saying, I'm sorry to everybody in the whole damn class. Actions speak louder than words, or in your cases, maybe fewer actions.
Fewer actions. Yeah. Yeah, agreed completely. But in the bigger picture, I also think this is a chance to really shift your perspective here. You've been trying to race through the material to get to the stuff you don't know. Which, again, I can totally appreciate. I understand your ambition, and I respect it. But if you just slow down a little bit, if you ease up on the impulse to prove how much you know all the time, if you spend a little more time thinking about your peers and their process and how they're developing, you might actually have a whole new experience of your program. You might realize that you don't know the material as well as you thought, and there's still more to learn. Or you might appreciate what you already know in a new way, just by slowing down, going deeper. Or you might find out what happens when you stop trying to get to the next thing and just listen. And that's a different type of learning. It's not as, you know, acquisitive and broad. It's deeper. It's more patient. It'll probably involve building better relationships with your peers, which is also very important. And that's even more valuable than being the smartest dude in the room all the time.
Great point. Because being smart, it's not the only good mark of a great physical therapist, right? He also has to be great with patients. He has to be collaborative. He's got to be outgoing, at least a little bit. He's got to be willing to grow, to learn, to see things in new ways. And this is a chance for him to develop those qualities too. So I totally understand your impulse to blend into the scenery and become furniture until you just vanish from people's memory. That's the natural response to being embarrassed, but I would actually do the opposite. I would lean in. Not lean in by talking more, but by engaging sincerely and respectfully with your classmates and your professors and showing them and showing yourself that you're willing to try things in a new way. And if you do that, I think you'll be amazed by how quickly you can rewrite your reputation. You've got the goods. Now you just have to balance them with your interpersonal skills. I know this is painful, but it doesn't have to be fatal. It can just be the beginning of a new phase in your development. So hey, that's what school's for. Stay open to that, and good luck. You can reach us at friday@jordanharbinger.com. Keep your emails concise. Use a descriptive subject line. Don't write Feedback Friday in the subject, please. Well, you can, but put something else in there too. If there's anything you're going through, a big decision that you're wrestling with, or you need a new perspective on stuff, life, love, work, what to do if you're afraid of being shot by a crazy family member at your mother-in-law's funeral, whatever's got you staying up at night lately, hit us up friday@jordanharbinger.com. We're here to help, and we keep every email anonymous.
By the way, Jordan, quick update on that. They did go to the funeral.
Oh, they did go to the funeral.
Just want everyone to know.
And did they get shot? Do we know?
As far as I know, nobody got shot, and I don't believe they had to wear bulletproof vests.
Oh, good. Yeah. Good news there. All right. What's next?
Dear Jordan and Gabriel, I'm a recently engaged 27-year-old in a long-distance relationship. Before dating, my fiancé and I were strictly friends for several months. During that time, I learned a lot about him, including the fact that he has had over 150 sexual partners. He also admitted to cheating on a previous partner and even convincing another woman to cheat on her boyfriend with him. We've had numerous conversations and arguments about how his behavior in his previous relationships makes me uncomfortable. I've always struggled to believe that out of 150 plus people whom he alleges he had genuine connections with, that I am the one. I recognize that my own insecurities prevent me from accepting his past. I've been cheated on multiple times by multiple partners before. We also both travel a lot for work, and he constantly talks about female friends he wants to catch up with over drinks or dinner wherever he travels. I often wonder if these are women he used to be intimate with. Sometimes I even ask. That said, he's gone out of his way to try to ease my mind. He's unfollowed people from social media, he's ignored messages from previous partners, and he's been transparent with me when they message him. Still, I can't help but wonder if I can trust him. Do you have any advice on how I can move forward in this relationship without feeling haunted by his past? Can people really change? Am I self-sabotaging? Or am I protecting myself? Signed, I got 99 problems, but apparently I'm the one.
More like 150 problems, am I right? So this is a really fascinating relationship. First of all, I gotta say you're being extremely open and self-aware about all this. I really appreciate how curious you are about these feelings, and it sounds like you're doing a great job of trying to separate your stuff from your fiancé's stuff, and I think that's terrific. Seriously, great mindset to have. So look, we could dissect this for hours, but I'll try to get to the point. You're afraid that your fiancé might cheat on you. You've been cheated on in the past multiple times. He has a busy past, a very busy past. I'm not going to judge him for his body count here. The number alone doesn't necessarily imply anything, although 150 certainly is up there. It does make me a little curious about his romantic patterns, but we can put that aside for now. He's cheated on a previous partner. He encouraged somebody else to cheat on her partner. You're long distance and you both travel, so theoretically, there's ample opportunity to cheat again. So this infidelity theme is obviously very charged for you, and this fear, it's not entirely unwarranted. At the same time, it sounds like your boyfriend is playing pretty fair here. He's unfollowing people. He's ignoring messages from other women. He's letting you know when they reach out. He's also literally telling you when he plans to catch up with female friends. He's not meeting them on the sly when he's got a 4-hour layover in Denver or whatever.
Denver, such a cheating city, is it not?
Everybody banging in Denver in the airport bathroom. I don't know. It doesn't sound gross, especially an airport bathroom. Like, ugh, gross. This doesn't sound like typical cheating behavior to me. This sounds like a guy who's being pretty respectful of your feelings. And he's doing the right thing by saying, hey, when I'm in Chicago, I'm going to grab a drink with Heather. Just want you to know so you don't think I'm hiding anything. Assuming he's not, I don't know, having emotional affairs with these women or keeping them on the back burner in case things don't work out with you or paying their rent or something sketchy like that. It all seems pretty legit to me. Hmm. Now, the big caveat to all this is the nature and the quality, and yeah, maybe even the quantity of these friendships. Look, if he's spending 3 nights a week grabbing Moscow mules with multiple other women and talking to them in a way that he doesn't talk to you, or he's putting himself in a situation where he could cheat, or he's just kind of getting off on the possibility of an affair, Yeah, that's a problem. It could be a bigger problem, and you guys need to get to the bottom of that. But if these are just legitimate friendships with women and he's being open with you about them, then this could very well be all on the up and up, which means that if you're still struggling to trust him, then that might speak to your stuff, your very normal and very understandable stuff. And this is something that you'll need to resolve primarily on your own, at least at first. And by that, I mean getting to the root of this fear of being deceived, betrayed, hurt by your partner, exploring this impulse to protect yourself, what you're protecting yourself from, how these past relationships have shaped your feelings about men, how you might be locating some of those earlier experiences in your current relationship, and also, to your point, when that impulse to protect yourself might turn into self-sabotage, as you put it, or some kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And just to run with that idea for a moment, if you are doing that, what function would that be serving? In other words, when you talk about self-sabotage, what would you hypothetically be sabotaging? Is it your connection to your fiance? Is it your happiness? Is it the vulnerability of deciding to trust him? And if so, why? I know these are very big questions, but if you really sit with those, you talk them out with a few people, maybe even you talk it out with your fiance, I think you'll have a much better handle on whether these feelings and questions you have, whether they're warranted, or if they're a reflection of some stuff on your side of the equation that you still have to work through.
I agree with everything you just said, Jordan. There's just one variable here that I'm not getting a good read on from her letter, which is, how does she feel about her fiance, right? Like, how does she feel in the relationship? How does she feel with him? Just on a basic day-to-day level, because I agree, this guy is being very open with her. And yes, she might be paranoid that he's going to cheat because of his past and her past, but she might also be paranoid because she's just not sure about this guy. Like, when she says she doesn't know if she can trust him, is she saying that because of his history, or is she saying that because she just doesn't feel very connected to him, or she doesn't always feel prioritized by him? Does she have some kind of gut feeling that there's something about him that is remote or unreachable, or that he sort of belongs to multiple people in some sense? And is that why she doesn't trust him?
Ah, interesting. Okay, I see what you're getting at. Like, it's not because of his past or these other women. It's maybe because of the quality of their relationship and her feelings in general.
Right.
Because if she knew in her bones that she was the only woman who mattered to him and that they were strong and connected, it might not bother her that he grabs drinks with an old friend or that he slept with 150 people in the past, because she'd know that the relationship is solid.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm getting at. And look, maybe it's just that they're long distance and that makes her feel a little disconnected from him. Understandably, this is why long distance relationships are very hard. Or maybe it just makes her worried about what might happen when they're not together. And that's what's getting to her.
True. But, you know, even if they are rock solid, it sounds like she's having some trouble accepting his feelings about her. Because like she said, she's always struggled to believe that out of 150 plus people, she's the one. And is that because of his body count, or is that more, by the way, that's such a weird, funny frat boy term, or is that more of a self-esteem issue on her part?
I think that's also a really great question, because she could look at that and go, yeah, he was with 150 plus people before me and I'm the one, right? He's dated a lot of people. He knows what's out there. He knows what he wants. He chose me. Or she could look at that as she is and go, man, he was with 150 people before me. Why in the world would he settle for me? It's such an interesting Rorschach test, what you take away from that fact, which confirms again that at least part of this is on her side of the equation.
I do think that it is, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a dance going on between the two of them here.
Sure.
His stuff is triggering her stuff is hooking into his stuff.
Yes.
This is a relationship.
Right.
But by the way, just circling back to the whole body count thing, if my own experience is any indication, at least 50 to 100 of the 150 people that dude has been with were probably just low-hanging fruit and he took the opportunity. I know lots of guys who used to really just get after it, especially in college. And there's a very important distinction between 150 relationships, which is kind of impossible, versus 150 people that you did the no pants dance with on your skanky dorm room futon. Okay. The truth is, a lot of guys just aren't ready to settle down until they're ready to settle down. And then they do, they settle down. I am one of those guys. So I sort of get where this guy's head might be, but I also get why that might seem somewhat sus to his fiance.
Yeah, I totally hear you. But let us not forget that he told her that most of those people he slept with were genuine connections, right? So What does that mean?
What else is he going to say? Yeah, I screwed anything that moves, but no, I don't do that anymore.
Okay, so you're saying he said that to make it sound better. Like, it wasn't just that I was getting...
I think so.
Yeah, like anything. Okay.
He doesn't want to be like, I used to be kind of a man whore, and now I have to sort of whitewash that and be like, no, I really liked all of them.
So he's like, no, I really cared about all of them. Okay, yeah.
And then it's like, oh, actually, that's even worse than just blindly getting too drunk at a college party and hooking up.
However, I also wonder if... he did on some level have some genuine connections with them. And that is also what worries her, because she's looking at his past and she's like, wait, you slept with over 150 people you actually cared for. Does that speak to the thing we were just talking about, where maybe she feels like he's available or connected to many other women, even if he's only with her? And maybe that's what doesn't sit right.
Yeah, I suppose. Well, we can speculate a lot on this, but anyway, like I said, if there's more going on here, if he, I don't know, has a sex addiction or just loves the attention, and he's playing in a weird gray area with these women, or he's prioritizing them over his fiance regularly, then that is an issue. So I'm not saying this is all in your head, you need to get over this. I'm saying let's appreciate what your fiance's past and behavior are bringing up for you and what you do with that. And then you can decide whether you're right or wrong and who needs to change and what they need to change.
Right, right.
Hondo P. There's another one of those, this phrase is definitely dead once I start using it.
How do you do, fellow kids?
What?
This never gets old, that clip. I love that.
No. But seriously, this would be such a great thing to bring into couples therapy, because it's a very rich topic, and how you guys communicate about all this, how you relate to each other, that's the key to resolving this. And my strong recommendation is to do that before you get married. If you do this together and it goes well, you guys will get a lot closer. It'll make your marriage much more successful. You don't want to sweep this under the rug until it detonates 9 months into your marriage. You guys need to explore all of this now. And I know it's uncomfortable, but it actually is a great opportunity to understand yourself and your relationship a whole lot better. So get to introspecting, get to talking, figure out what's your stuff and what's his stuff and what these relationships are about. And I'm sure you're going to get more clarity on what's really causing this anxiety. And good luck. You know what else you're going to want on that skanky dorm room futon? Something from the amazing sponsors who support this show.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
We'll be right back. If you like this episode of Feedback Friday and you found our advice valuable, I invite you to do what other smart and considerate listeners do, which is take a moment and support our amazing sponsors. All of the deals and discount codes are all in one place. JordanHarbinger.com/deals is where you can find it. You can also search for any sponsor using the search box on the website as well. Thank you so much for supporting those who support us. All right, back to Feedback Friday. What's next?
Dear Jordan and Gabe, I was diagnosed with clinical depression 8 years ago and have been on meds and in and out of therapy. I still have depressive episodes now and again, but they usually last a day or two and are pretty manageable. However, I had one such episode last me a couple of weeks this month. I couldn't get out of bed, barely ate one meal a day, and completely ignored my responsibilities. Eventually, I was able to claw my way out, and I have appointments set up with a therapist and a psychiatrist. The biggest problem I have now is with my work-from-home sales job, which I started a few months ago. I like this job, and I see this as the start of a successful career, but I completely neglected it, and my numbers reflect that. My manager was unhappy with my numbers last month, but he didn't press the issue because I'm still new. But with this month's numbers being just as much of a disaster, he won't be happy again, and he said that I won't be around for longer if my numbers are this low. I don't want to be fired, but I also don't want to use my depression as an excuse for my abysmal performance. How can I explain what happened without it looking like I'm coming up with excuses? And how do I convey that I want to stay and succeed in this position? Signed, staying out of double trouble as I deal with the mubble fubbles.
Did you say mubble fubbles? Is that real? Did you make that up? What is that?
No, that's it means like the blues, the blahs, depression. It's a really good word, right?
I've never heard of that. Mubble fubbles. Yeah, it's fun to say. Mm-hmm. Mubble fubbles. I guess I've never heard that before. Well, listen, I'm really sorry to hear that you've been struggling with the mubble fubbles, as many people do, depression can be, it's a laughing matter now. Depression can be obviously very debilitating. It can be super isolating. It can create a lot of anxiety and shame when your performance at work takes a hit. I totally understand that. But I got to say, you're doing so many things right here. You're doing so many things right. You found the resources you need. You've landed a job you really like. Even now, when you're struggling a bit, you've reached out to us for help. Not always easy to do that kind of stuff. And you're not using the depression to justify a less than great performance. You're giving yourself some grace here. Cool. But you're also not letting yourself off the hook. And again, that's a very mature mindset. And I want to give you props here for that. So here's what I'm thinking. Since you're new at this job, and since it can be a little tricky to tell a boss, especially a new boss, hey, I'm so depressed, I can barely pour myself a bowl of Cap'n Crunch, let alone hit my sales targets, I would keep your explanation brief, and I would keep it focused on your performance rather than the cause. You might want to grab 10 minutes with your boss and say, hey, listen, I know the last couple months haven't been my best. I've been struggling to hit my targets. Candidly, I've been going through a bit of a tough time. We don't need to get into that. I just want to let you know what's going on. I am also disappointed by my numbers. I'm sure you are as well. I just want to say that I really love working here. I want to crush it. I see myself here long term. So please don't take my latest numbers as a reflection of my feelings for this job. I'm on it and I intend to turn the ship around next month. Something like that. Your goal should be to acknowledge what's going on without tipping over into excuses or justifications. All you need to communicate is, hey, we're on the same page. Thank you for giving me a little wiggle room to get my house in order. Please have some faith in me. Now, that's the language that'll buy you some time. After that, of course, you got to live up to those words. So the real question is how to continue performing well when you're struggling with depression. And let's just acknowledge that can be really hard. Being depressed makes it tough to stay connected to your goals, to have the energy to pick up the phone, to visit customers, chase down leads, take care of yourself and all these other areas of your life. It's debilitating. I am not going to minimize that. But you have so many of these pieces in place, and you've gone through these dips before, and you made it out. So you know that these periods are temporary. So what I would do is come up with a system for taking care of your life, even when you are feeling blue. And that system looks different for different people. But for you, it'll probably mean a few things. First off, come up with a set of habits and processes that'll service your goals, even when you don't, quote unquote, feel like it. So maybe that means automating and scheduling your customer outreach emails. Maybe that means calendaring your sales calls and committing to just getting through those calls, even if you're not hitting on all cylinders. Maybe it means scheduling a check-in with your boss every 2 weeks to see how your numbers are looking. Keep yourself in the game, so to speak. Maybe it means finding one or two coworkers that you vibe with, people you like and hopefully trust, to keep yourself accountable to your goals. And I know the word accountable, it's a little annoying. I'm not a fan of it either, but this stuff works. We don't even have to call it accountable. Let's just call it connected. Then, when you're having an off week, you can go pick up the phone or grab lunch with a colleague and go, man, I'm struggling this week. I could use a little help. And then you can invite them to give you a dose of encouragement or some advice or a little sales support or even just a friendly ear so you can keep going. And I would offer to do the same thing for them. By the way, that's another great antidote to depression, going deeper into your relationships. I don't know about you, but when I felt really down in the past, it was often because I felt kind of useless, disconnected, isolated, and deliberately investing into your relationships. That really keeps you feeling like you have a purpose and a role in other people's lives and vice versa. And then there's all the other obvious stuff. I'm not going to go all life coach on you here, but getting good sleep, exercising regularly, taking your medication, seeing your therapist regularly, avoiding alcohol and crappy food, answering your text messages, making time to go outside, doing one or two things that give you joy, all of that. I'm sure you already know this, but it's really important to stick to those simple habits, especially when you feel yourself entering a dip. And by the way, I do all this myself even when I'm not down. In fact, this is how I manage to avoid getting down in the first place. I think of it as the architecture that holds all these pieces together that makes my life run. And the beautiful thing is, if you set it up right, most days just feel like you're servicing something that was created for you. And you don't have to constantly muster up the energy to do life. You're just doing the things that you set up for yourself in advance, and your life kind of takes care of itself. It's so simple. It definitely works.
I love that, Jordan. You know, I've also been through some real dips in my life, and I know how hard they can be. I really do. Like, I feel for this guy. But one of the best things I've learned is to embrace however you're feeling, even when it's pretty shitty, and know that you can still show up. Because when I was younger, it's funny, I used to think like, oh, I'm sad today. I guess I can't do anything. And then as I worked through some of this stuff and I found a better way of handling my projects, I started to realize that, yeah, I can be sad, or I can be bored, or I can just be kind of uninspired, and I can still do what I have to do. Like, look, you can wake up feeling kind of blue one day, and you can still call a few customers on the phone. You just call them a little bit blue. You can feel like hitting your sales targets is completely meaningless and still send out 10 emails from a template you created last month. You just email them without any meaning. You don't necessarily need to be in a certain mood to do the thing in front of you.
Totally. All you have to do is do the thing that's in front of you.
Literally, oftentimes, all you have to do. And the funny thing is, if you just do that one thing, and then, you know, you get that little burst of energy, you use it to do one more thing, and then one more thing, there's no way you're going to end that day feeling worse than you did at the beginning.
Right. Worst case scenario, you feel the exact same, except you actually did your job that day. You're making progress, and you're not freaking out because you're going to get fired in a month, which almost always means you're going to feel better than when the day began.
Exactly. And I'd be willing to bet that if you kept showing up, even when you're down, even when you can only give 30%, these dips won't be as frequent or as severe, because what you're also doing is you're working with your feelings, you're opening up to other people, you're staying in the game, as opposed to withdrawing and contracting and hiding away, which is what depression really wants to do and where it thrives. If you can do that, look, I'm not saying the depression will completely lift or that depression is just a matter of showing up every day and that's all, you know, I understand that these things have deep roots and you should be working on all of that. But if you can do this, it probably won't dictate your whole experience and it probably won't derail your career. And when you realize that you can still perform even when you're down, that'll give you some new confidence and it'll give you a little bit of motivation. And that could also help lift you out of these dips as well, or at least raise the floor on them a little bit so they don't feel quite so bad.
Yeah, I like that advice. I definitely agree there. By the way, everything you said applies just as much to feeling angry or scared or bored. Mm. All of those feelings are just feelings.
Yes.
It's such a great thing to remember. You don't need to feel X way to do Y thing. You could just do the thing and let the feelings be what they are. And 9 times out of 10, your actions are going to change your feelings, not the other way around. I had a boss in the 90s where when somebody came in or wouldn't come in and they said, I don't feel good, he'd go, oh, I don't need you to feel good. I just need you to show up and do your job. And I remember hearing that. I guess he got that from the military or something. And he's like, I remember I had like a fever and I went in. And he's like, oh, you really are sick. I was like, yeah, I told you I don't feel good. He's like, well, you know, you don't need to feel good, but I really, you look like crap. You're going to be a driver today. You're not going to stand in the venue. And because a lot of guys would call in and just be like, I'm tired. I don't feel good. And he's like, yeah, dude, I don't need you. You know, these weren't guys who had real issues like the person writing in. But again, I don't mean to be too flippant about depression. I know the answer to being depressed isn't just like, take your colleague to lunch and do push-ups and just keep showing up. Sometimes depression can actually be so severe, you can't even do things badly, let alone well. I get it. I mean, there's I've got friends where like I was stuck in bed for 3 days. That's a thing. Apollo Ono talked about this on the show. But I do believe that the collection of these habits and systems and mindsets, again, that architecture, that's what makes these periods doable. And if you're having an off day or two, you don't need to hit it out of the park. You just need to stay in the game, like Gabe said. So yeah, talk to your boss, get that second chance. But more importantly, create that architecture and that scaffolding to live up to that second chance. And if you do that, I'm very confident you're going to get through the dip and probably perform even better than you have in the past. You've got this, man. We're sending you good thoughts. And soon you'll be back in the game and you'll be able to have coffee with the rest of the team. But until then,
put that coffee down. Coffee's for closers only.
All right. But don't worry. You'll be a closer yourself soon enough. All right. What's next?
Dear Jordan and Gabe, I'm a woman from France, and recently I've noticed a ton of reels on Instagram going viral about Saudi Arabia. Most of them involve female influencers showing a beautiful landscape or resort and encouraging people to visit, tagged with hashtag ad or hashtag sponsored and hashtag visit Saudi. The comment section is pretty wild. Most commenters will leave nice comments like, yes, and so beautiful. But if you scroll to the bottom, you get the occasional human rights abuses, no thanks, and I can't wear a bikini there, that kind of stuff. Personally, I would not go to Saudi Arabia at this time, as a woman and as a Westerner. I know the government may not represent the people, and I have nothing against the country or its people. I'm just uncomfortable with the situation and financially supporting the government, let alone my personal safety. But anytime I've tried to engage with people in the comments about why I wouldn't go, people fire back with stuff the US and France have done. They'll say things like, well, the US isn't a good place to visit if you're a woman or a person of color either, or, well, I'd never go to France because of what you did to Algeria, as if I'm responsible for the Algerian war. Of course, if you think about all the bad stuff every country has done, nobody would travel anywhere. Why are influencers all of a sudden promoting tourism to Saudi Arabia? And more importantly, how can I sit with the moral dilemma about visiting countries that are actively committing human rights violations? Signed, getting a cramp over these passport stamps.
That's an interesting question. So first of all, influencers are promoting tourism to Saudi Arabia because they're being paid for it, plain and simple. There was actually an article about this in the New York Times a few years back. We can link to it in the show notes if we can find it. If I recall correctly, the Ministry of Tourism basically invites influencers to visit the country on their dime. And in exchange, they post photos from famous landmarks and beautiful views promoting the country. It's just like any other form of advertising. It's just on Instagram and TikTok where this stuff does really well. And China does a ton of this. They invite, in fact, we did a show about this. They'll invite somebody to go to Xinjiang and they're like, there's no genocide here. Look at me in this market that only has tourists in it. And there's three Chinese people following me with video cameras that I totally am not here with. It's insane, actually. The article talked about this exact thing, the ethical conflicts involved in promoting a country that carries out human rights abuses, controls its citizens, murders journalists in foreign countries, and the backlash that influencers get for this kind of stuff. It's tricky territory, for sure. But you're right. If you look at all the horrible stuff every country has done, nobody would travel anywhere. I mean, okay, look at the US. Tourists come here all the time. America is held in pretty high regard. We've done some pretty insane stuff as a country, and we still do. I'm not equating the US with Saudi Arabia by any means, but we have to admit that we live in an ethically ambiguous world, and it's not easy to boycott bad countries because the whole world is flawed and the whole global system is interconnected. So, there's really no way to avoid supporting evil stuff entirely. I mean, try never buying gas again. Oh, and nothing made from petroleum products like plastic. I mean, that's how you don't support countries like that. Not by not staying at a hotel and taking photos. But I understand. So in my opinion, you can only really do your best to avoid the really awful places and decide where to draw the line for yourself. For example, I won't go to China anymore. Not just because it's unsafe for me, after doing so many episodes about the Chinese Communist Party, but because I don't feel right supporting a country that perpetuates human rights abuses. And I'm thinking about the Uyghur genocide in particular, but there's obviously a ton of terrible stuff that the government perpetuates out there. Again, it's not the people, it's the government, et cetera. But by the same token, I wouldn't, I don't know, hop on a plane to Eritrea to check out their amazing archaeology. I mean, I'm happy they allocated an entire coastline as a nature reserve or whatever, and they love to brag about that. But it doesn't feel right to me to support a country that muzzles journalists and disappears citizens who speak out against the regime. But it took me many years and a lot of homework to get to this point. It wasn't long ago that Gabe and I were traveling to North Korea. I mean, we only went a few times, but we did run a blog encouraging tourism there, which, wow, Gabe, I guess that makes us early travel influencers for the worst country on earth. But, all, you know, they didn't pay us for that, by the way. That we did for free, which is even worse somehow.
I was about to say, I guess we were no better than these Instagram models hyping supper clubs in Riyadh or whatever. Yeah,
I know, hilarious. I feel like if TikTok were a thing back then when we were doing that, we would have been dragged and rightly so, but we just weren't as thoughtful about this stuff back then. We weren't doing interviews and reading a ton about these places. I mean, we knew that the place was crazy.
Sure.
But it was more like, hey, look, we're engaging, we're encouraging people to learn more about other places. And we weren't whitewashing what we saw. I think that was also important.
For sure. We actually talked about a lot of the dark stuff when we were covering
it. We
did.
We talked about a lot of the dark stuff. And you're not allowed to do that when you're invited to Saudi Arabia and they pay for everything. You can't say, look at this amazing stadium paid for by migrant labor that's basically treated like slavery. I wonder how many people died building this. You can't do that. We weren't edited by what we were allowed to say about or in North Korea after we left, I should say. After we left, we weren't allowed, you know, after we left, we could say whatever we want. So I guess on some level, I can understand why these young influencers separate politics from travel and money, and they just go to have a cool trip and make some dough. It's a business. They're not politicians. I get it. But also, if you're taking money from a country, you got to be more thoughtful, in my opinion. It's just no different from me vetting sponsors before we advertise them on the show. I can't promote any products I don't believe in. I turn down a ton of money for stuff I don't like that I wouldn't use myself. So why should influencers promote countries that they would never go to live in? I think that's a fair point. And look, that's my take. Just don't go to these countries, the really bad ones. But also, decide for yourself what your standard is, what you consider acceptably bad and what you consider unconscionably bad. Unfortunately, you can't avoid supporting some evil practices somewhere in the world these days. I mean, look, you can hop on a flight to, say, New Zealand and never use anything made out of plastic. Lovely country, famously friendly, famously pretty good about not hurting people. But, you know, the Boeing 737 is still going to have parts manufactured in China, jet fuel made from oil in Saudi Arabia, probably. So as sad as it is, you just have to accept that and do your best.
Man, Jordan, we're leaving so much money on the table not shilling for dictators abroad anymore. It's like really a shame.
Tell me about it. How do we not jump on the TikTok wave and become travel influencers for Kim Jong-un when we had the chance? I mean, we were doing it all wrong. Could go to Belarus and clean up. There's probably not a whole lot of people rolling over to Minsk and hanging out with Lukashenko. Nah, just playing. I'd rather be at home in my new fuzzy Bombas reading about horrible things in the Atlantic instead. And by the way, Gabriel, there's the difference here, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it earlier, but the real key here is these travel influencers, they're going to Saudi Arabia and they're not, look, I know people that go to Eritrea and they're like, wow, here's the downside, but here's the rest of it. And the people are cool. When you are paid by the government tourism bureau to go somewhere, you are not allowed to film and talk about certain things. You can't go to Saudi Arabia and go, man, look at these labor violations. Look at how some of the poor people live. Hey, by the way, did you know that they call MBS Mohammed Bonesaw because he murdered that journalist? This place has a lot of contradictions. If you are a random tourist and you come to the United States, you can film homeless people and say, they got a big homeless problem. Look at this. This is really bad, but I had a lot of fun on my vacation. You are being a mouthpiece for the tourism bureau. You are helping whitewash their reputation. So if you're okay with that and everything is disclosed and you say, hey, I got paid to do this and I had fun on my trip, I know there's a lot of sketchy stuff about Saudi Arabia. That's one thing. But you're being, in my opinion, a little bit unethical if you go there and you're like, this place is amazing. I'm wearing a bikini on the beach, knowing full well that you're on a tourist beach and that women are in burqas sitting in the sand in 100 degree heat just around the corner and you're not allowed to go there and they're not allowed to talk to you. Mm. There's just a big difference there, right? When we went to North Korea, and again, you know, we can relitigate that and justify it or not all we want, but we went there and we know there's a lot of starvation. We saw malnourished people and soldiers at the tourist attractions. We got some photos of that stuff. It's really a ton of contradictions. We had an interesting time there. Yeah. This place is sorely lacking. Mm-hmm. It's really unfree. You know, but we weren't being paid by Kim Jong-un to be like, come here, look at these water slides and how happy everyone is. We were very honest about that. And you can't do that if you are a mouthpiece for the government as a travel influencer. And that's the big difference.
Right.
I think that's the difference. You can go be a tourist wherever the hell you want and see whatever you want, but don't lie for the government. Don't lie for the regime. That's my ethical boundary here. And I think that's what this person is saying, is these people, these influencers are just taking the check and then saying whatever the government wants. I hope you all enjoyed that. I want to thank everyone who wrote in this week and everybody who listened. Thank you so much. Go back and check out Apollo Ono and Rami Romani if you haven't yet. You want to know how I managed to book all these great people and manage relationships using software, systems, and tiny habits? Our 6-minute networking course is a free course where I teach you how to do just that. It's over on the Thinkific platform at jordanharbinger.com/course. I'm teaching you how to dig the well before you get thirsty. Don't try to build relationships when you need them. Build them beforehand. This takes just a few minutes a day. I wish I knew this stuff 20 years ago. I've been using it for a decade. It's really helped me in my personal and business life. It's been really crucial, in fact. Again, free, jordanharbinger.com/course. A link to the show notes for the episode can be found at jordanharbinger.com. Transcripts in the show notes, advertisers, deals, discount codes, all at jordanharbinger.com/deals. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on Twitter and Instagram. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn. You can find Gabe on Instagram at Gabriel Mizrahi or on Twitter at Gabe Mizrahi. This show is created in association with Podcast One. My team is Jen Harbinger, Jace Sanderson, Robert Fogarty, Ian Baird, Millie Ocampo, Josh Ballard, and of course, Gabriel Mizrahi. Our advice and opinions are our own, and I'm a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer and never was a good lawyer, so do your own research before implementing anything you hear on the show. Remember, we rise by lifting others. Share the show with those you love, and if you found the episode useful, please share it with somebody else who can use the advice that we gave here today. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen, and we'll see you next time. Here's a sample of my interview with Maria Konnikova, who went from being someone who had no interest whatsoever in poker to raking in big bucks as an international poker champion. Here's a quick look inside.
Poker is actually the perfect game for human decision-making because it's a game of incomplete information. No one cares where the hell you went to school. No one cares what you look like. No one cares what you did or didn't do. If you can afford the buy-in, great. So there are people sitting at the table, some of whom have Ivy League educations, others of whom dropped out of high school and had to wrestle with homelessness and built up their bankroll from $10 and took that $10 and are now millionaires. We make decisions and incorporate things that really shouldn't matter all the time, like the weather. We don't realize that we're depressed because it's raining outside and instead we're like, oh, life sucks, everything sucks. But it's so cool that if you draw someone's attention to the reason why they're feeling this way, they're totally capable of discounting it and saying, oh, okay, yeah, I'm depressed right now, but it's because of the weather. Can you figure out not just your own triggers, but the other person's triggers? Some people, when they lose a lot, they're going to become really cautious because they don't want to lose even more. Some people, when they lose a lot, are going to become extra reckless because they want to gain it back very, very quickly. Same event, totally different reactions. Can I try to figure out what the psychological dynamic for this person is? How do they react to loss? Some people, when they win a lot, they're going to become extra cautious because now they don't want to lose it. They're like, oh, I have all these chips. I want to guard them. Other people, when they win a lot, they're like, yeah, let's push my advantage. Let's go. If you can start to figure out and pull apart things like that, all of a sudden you have a really good psychological picture of the person and you can take advantage of it. This really intrigued me and I thought, let me read more about this poker thing and decided, hey, you know what? This is my book. Why don't I learn poker? Why don't I actually see how far I can go? And I ended up becoming good and winning a major international title and getting a sponsorship from PokerStars and joining Team Pro and somehow found myself as a professional poker player.
For more, including how people make decisions and what poker can tell us about reading human motivation, how to spot real physical tells at the poker table and in real life, and how we can control and prevent emotional thinking, aka going on tilt, check out episode 371 of The Jordan Harbinger Show with Maria Konnikova.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.